Okay, we're back to the Gospel of Matthew in another Wednesday evening. Last Wednesday, we had discussed most of Matthew chapter 15 and part of chapter 16. We picked up from where we had left off with the story of the Canaanite woman. I just noticed something in my 16 commentary from 2011 that I have actually, until 5 minutes ago, totally forgot was there. I don't have time to go and keep rereading my own commentaries, right? I just forge ahead with new ones every week and don't look back. Very rare that I search my own commentaries. So sometimes I probably repeat myself for that reason, but Yahweh willing, I hope I never contradict myself. I mean, I don't think I have, but I'm sure maybe in some small way. Anyway, I've been in conjunction with this custom of the suppliant in the Canaanite woman story, and I did a podcast in 2013 which discussed that very thing at great length. Forgot that I had already discussed that in my 2011 commentary. So I want to just repeat this because I think this is the most important aspect to understand of the culture in order to understand why Christ had healed the Canaanite woman's daughter. She agreed to him. She admitted to his authority. And she also admitted that she was nothing but a dog, basically in his eyes. She agreed with that. She said, but even the dogs eat the crumbs under the table of the children. So she admitted she's not one of the children. And for that, she received the crumb, basically. She didn't receive eternal salvation. She didn't receive a seat at the table with the children. She didn't receive anything that she wasn't entitled to before the conversation, except one favor, which was that it would be to her as she desired, which was the desire that she had expressed that he heal her daughter, and she admitted his power and ability to do that. It has to be understood in the context of the culture at the time. And that's why I try to stress this aspect of Greek and Roman culture. So this is from a book, Clemency and Cruelty in the Roman World by Melissa Barden Dowling, and titled Clemency and Cruelty Under the Julio-Claudians. Now, that's the, of course, the family of Julius Caesar's descendants and the adopted heirs that succeeded him on the throne through the time of Claudius, which is basically through 50-something AD. And through the entire life of Christ was the time of the Julio-Claudians. And she has a citation here. Let them hate so long as they fear. Gaius Caligula's policy toward those who offended him and those who did not was carried out in actions of open brutality. Fear is a tool of rulership, and his disinterest and even the appearance of mercy stood in contrast to the averred principles of his predecessors and most of his successors. Talking about Gaius Caligula, she's speaking about the emperor immediately before Tiberius, who was the emperor at the time of Christ. For others, clementia or clemency was the watchword, advertised by princeps or principles or laws, senators and subjects alike, the reality or the princes of Rome. The reality of imperial cruelty was inescapable, however, and the proclamations of imperial clemency were often loudest when an emperor's savagery was most sharply felt. Gaius departed from Augustus, discarding the careful assurances of clemency, often their rule. Gaius's successors did not repeat his error. In other words, they went back to the traditions of Augustus and Tiberius. During the reigns of Claudius and Nero, the dialogue of clemency or clementia continued in both imperial and elite propaganda. And I'm sorry, Gaius Caligula was the emperor immediately following Tiberius Caesar, the Caesar Christ. Tiberius Caesar practiced this clementia or this clemency that the author is about to speak of. In fact, the definition of clementia or clemency developed further under the Julio-Claudians, surpassing the scope it had held under Augustus. It was under Nero that the first philosophy of clemency was described by Seneca. In his theory of mercy, Seneca constructed a parallel philosophy of cruelty, outlining the degrees of irrationality that underlie cruel actions and highlighting the contrasting benefits of clemency. From Gaius's naked crudelitas to a sophisticated philosophy of clemency, in the Julian-Claudian age, Romans experimented with the vocabulary of power and ultimately created a stronger ethic mercy to offset the power of the emperor. So these things reflect long-standing customs and traditions in Greece and Rome. But here, those customs and traditions are seen in only in the context of the power of the emperor himself, but they were practiced all over the empire by all men and by all rulers, by mayors or leaders of cities and regional governors, judges had all practiced these same traditions. So the normalization of imperial advertisements of the clementia principis and the creation of a philosophy of virtus or manly virtue, incorporating clemency as an expression of a good man's success, were outstanding developments of the ideology and social history of the earlier empire. These developments and the emergence of a parallel philosophy of cruelty, in which the degradation of man's nature was expressed through his cruelty, are the focus of this chapter. That's what she's going to go on to explain. And once we understand that the Canaanite woman came to Christ as a suppliant did to a king, in obeisance to him and agreeing with him and supplicating to him in every manner, and once we understand the social philosophy of the time reflected Roman law of clementia or clemency, then do we realize that Christ had little choice in the cultural context, and in order to demonstrate his own sense of justice and virtue and mercy, he had little choice than to grant her what she desired, which she knew and professed was fully within his power. So therefore, he granted her wish for his own benefit and not for hers, and that's a sign to us. So that's my position on the Canaanite woman. It's never going to change because that's the tradition of the time, and Christ had functioned. Even though he was God come in the flesh, he wasn't revealed to be God. And even though the people knew that he was a he didn't sit as a king, didn't seek to be a king, but he acted like a king. So following the customs of the time, he did it for his own benefit and for the sake of his people and not for the Canaanite woman. She benefited from it, but only as a dog getting a scrap under the table. And that's how she remains. That being said, I noticed something else that I didn't see last week, and that's this interpolation in Matthew chapter 16 in verses 2 and 3, which I omitted from the Christogenean New Testament, and I will continue to omit it, but it is found in Luke chapter 12. Very similarly, it's found in Luke chapter 12, very similar to the manuscripts here that include it. But just because something's found in Luke doesn't want to make me include it in Matthew when the manuscripts of Matthew indicate that it should not be included, which is the case here. And that's all I have to say for an introduction. That's where we are now. In Matthew chapter 15, we saw another miraculous feeding of thousands of people with very little food at the end of the chapter. And then the people sought for a sign. The Pharisees and Sadducees had come to him and sought for a sign. And he responded to them that a wicked and adulterous race seeks a sign, and a sign shall not be given to it except the sign of Jonas. And of course, that's the 3 days and three nights, which he spent in the belly of the earth as at the time of his crucifixion. That's the only sign they were going to receive. And they denied that sign when they received it. But of course, he knew. With that, we can continue with Luke chapter 16 with verse 5, unless somebody else has anything to say.
And the students, having come to the other side, forgot to take bread. Then Yahshua said to them, "Watch and be on guard because of the leaven of the Pharisees and Sadducees." And they disputed among themselves, saying that we did not take bread. But Yahshua, knowing it, said, "Why do you dispute among yourselves, you of little faith, because you do not have bread? Do you not yet perceive, nor do you remember the 5 loaves of the 5,000 and how many baskets you had taken? Nor the 7 loaves of the 4,000 and how many creels you had taken? How do you not perceive that it is not concerning wheat loaves that I spoke to you, but be on guard because of the leaven of the Pharisees and Sadducees?" Then they understood that he did not say to be on guard because of the leaven of the wheat loaves, but because of the teaching of the Pharisees and Sadducees.
We can see 11 of the Pharisees and the Sadducees throughout the Roman Catholic Church, throughout the writings of Flavius Josephus. Sometimes Flavius Josephus doesn't realize that he's spreading that leaven, and sometimes he's actually explaining that leaven, not in those terms.
It's in all the churches, Bill, all the mainstream churches, the leaven of the Pharisees, this universalism and...
Well, yes, but I said Roman Catholic Church because that was the first big church, right? It was the first Christendom-wide church. So all the other denominations today, all the other churches have it because they, in those areas, they've assumed that the Roman Catholics were right for 1,500 years when they weren't.
And weren't the Pharisees baptizing anyone and then they became part of their little temple or whatever? And today we, you know, we're baptizing niggers and we're baptizing chinks and then they're supposedly Christians. They're supposedly part of the faith somehow. So that came from them, didn't it?
Yes, the Talmud has descriptions of how to convert someone to be a Jew. And they have ritual baths, which are called mikvahs, and they use the ritual baths for other purposes, right? For other rituals for Jews, but they use the mikvahs in order to baptize someone into Judaism. So they use those ritual baths, and that baptism, that act of baptism, is that old. It's that the Pharisees and the Sadducees didn't go to John the Baptist and ask why he was baptizing people. If you read the law of Moses, the only people that were ever baptized regular rituals, priests. and not the people. Of course, if the people had come across something unclean, they were told to wash themselves. But that's not a regular ritual, right? That's an irregular ritual, because you're only expected to do it when you come across something unclean, come into contact with something unclean. So the priests alone had regular rituals in the Old Testament, but these Judeans, by the time of Christ, developed this baptism as a ritual. And yes, they used it for conversions. And that's how the people must have understood the baptism of John the Baptist. So what we read in the Talmud about these mikveh baths and these baptisms, it must have existed before the time of John the Baptist. It must have already been developed as a tradition by then. Or the people, they didn't ask John the Baptist why he was baptizing people. They only asked him who gave him the authority to baptize people. So Clifton Emmaheiser had cited John Lightfoot's commentary, which is actually pretty good, on the baptism rituals and of the Jews, and they used it to convert, to magically convert these non-Judeans, non-Israelites, to be Judeans. And they considered them Judeans once they were converted with these baptism rituals. And that's where the Catholic Church got its baptism ritual from. They got it from the Jews, but it doesn't come from the Bible. John the Baptist had a particular purpose to conduct those baptisms, but it wasn't supposed to be a Christian ritual. And it was never intended to be how men became Christians.
Yeah, universalism started with that.
Baptist was I think people that were already Israelites, so that as a symbol of their repentance, but not to convert them to be Israelites.
And just as a side note, Bill, you know those tunnels that the Jews were digging in New York or whatever? They dug those tunnels so that they could access the mikvah, because they use that little mikvah so that they can perform all kinds of sodomy, and it's disgusting what they do at their little mikvahs. But that's why they dug those tunnels in New York, is that they could access their mikvah.
That tunnel in New York went to a female mikvah. In Jewish synagogues, the females and the males have separate parts. And I'm pretty sure that tunnel in New York went to the female mikvah, to the woman's mikvah.
So the men dug it out for the women, so that they, you know, because I read an article about that, but I guess I'm wrong about it. But I read an article saying that they dug it out, so, and they related it to whatever they do there, you know, the disgusting things they do.
Yes, I'm pretty sure I read that it read that it led to the woman's mikvah in an adjoining building.
Maybe they were being peeping Toms or something.
They had to be doing something. They're always up to no good.
I actually did write that in the post I made on a media site titled Jewish Tunnel Tales. That the famous Chabad Lubavitch Synagogue in Crown Heights, Brooklyn, in New York, inside of a dispute over an illegal tunnel. Evidently, a tunnel was dug from the synagogue area into the area of a woman's mikvah, or ritual bath, in a nearby building. They were probably committing all sorts of adultery down in that tunnel.
But Bill, back to the baptism, I mean, I don't know where they get being baptized will change your blood. Israel is by blood. You know, it's amazing. We got farmers that will raise pure Angus cattle, and they're so careful with the DNA and not mixing it. They'll even pay $12 million for a tube of sperm off of a special racehorse and then let their daughter crawl up under a nigger, okay?
Right.
I don't understand.
I totally agree. I don't know where the Jews got the idea that you could be converted into an Israelite in a mikvah. But that's what John Lightfoot wrote about, and he got it right from the Talmud. It could be, I know it's there. It's I don't know the passages. But that is what Christ said to them when they search high and low for a proselyte. When they find one, they make them twofold the child of hell that they are.
There's that, I don't know where the verse is, but there's that verse, you know, though you take much so, your sin is still marked before me. It's like you can't wash it off.
Yeah, Jeremiah
right,
2.
That's Jeremiah chapter 2.
Thank you.
Yeah, they likely thought you could bring a nigger or a Canaanite into this ritual bath and turn him in, like, clean off the unclean blood. Or clean off
the nigger.
Yeah, because they understood that the other races were profane or unclean. They understood that. They didn't understand why. So they likely thought they could change it.
Yeah, we've lost the importance of blood. We've lost that. We used to talk about blood. Someone had bad blood with someone. That used to be discussed. It's no longer discussed. Blood's not even an issue anymore. Dip them in water. They're Israelites.
You know what is? You can actually clean a profane animal. Like if a cow's been mishandled or something, you can make a profane thing clean. You can make a prostitute who's an Israelite. She can be made clean. She might be profane when she's a prostitute, but she can repent and be made clean. They might have taken that idea and said, oh, well, why can't we clean a pig? Why can't we clean a nigger? Why can't, you know? So they failed to discern the difference between the profane and the unclean, and that's also in the prophets.
Yeah. The battles from front to back in the Bible is about blood. Read it.
In Ezekiel, it says, you know, the priest have failed to discern between the clean and the profane.
Yeah, in the temple vision.
You know, in Acts chapter 13, Peter described the baptism of John, and he said, preached before his coming, before the coming of Christ, the baptism of repentance to all the people of Israel. The New Testament baptism of conversion, it's a baptism of repentance to all.
All these verses which nominate Israel, man. Like, what's going on? I'm starting to think it means something.
I think we're... sorry.
Paul even said, you know, Paul said, whose are the fathers... Whose are the, you know, the promises, the baptism, the election, all that. You know, I'm going to find that verse because I'm sure it says baptism there.
You know how you were saying that they might have tried to turn unclean into clean, but that's, I think, misguided noble intentions, but they didn't have any of that, right? So it's not like they were benevolent and they just screwed it up. They're doing it because it makes them rich. And that's the same way that all pagan religions worked, right? The more people you had in it, the more wealth and power you had. And that's the only motivation. It's not that they're misguided.
Right. They're misguiding the people, though. Mark describes the baptism in the opening of his gospel. The same way, John bid to the wilderness and preached the baptism of repentance for the remission of sins. And of course, only Israel was under the law, so only Israel could sin or could be held accountable and need to be cleansed of their sins. And they went and they went out to him, all the land of Judea, and they of Jerusalem, and were all baptized of him in the river Jordan, confessing their sins. So a confession of sin is related to the act of repentance and the baptism.
And that's why John quoted Isaiah saying that he was coming to straighten the paths and make smooth the rugged ways, or I'm paraphrasing, right? And that's that's representing the people becoming obedient through repentance, and that obedient people paved the way for Christ.
And it was John himself. I'm not sure. It might be in John chapter 7. I'm looking for it now. John himself explained that the Pharisees didn't come to ask him why he was baptizing, but to ask him who gave him the authority to baptize. Proves right there that they must have been baptizing, and they were baptizing for conversion. As it's explained in the Talmud just a few centuries later.
Yeah, later the Pharisees come to Christ and they ask him, by whom do you have the authority to do these things? And he says, the baptism of John, is it from heaven or from men? Of men? And then they say, oh, we don't know. And then he says, neither do I tell you where I get my authority.
And the apostles, they took this lesson really well, because throughout their epistles, they're always warning of Judaizers. Paul, he warred with them. Peter, he warred with them. They're always warring and warning of them. And of course, the Judaizers won the battle in the end, and that led to the Catholic Church. And recently, like 2 days ago, my wife and I were reading, and we decided to read 3 John and Philemon, because those are two books which I feel like are overlooked, at least for me. I like, at this point, we can pretty much quote any book of the Bible except those two, because they just don't really come up often. So I'm like, okay, we're going to read them again and just see what we can extract from them for like our tool belt. So we're reading 3 John, and in 3 John, it's so interesting, and I have so much more value from 3 John now, because in 3 John, he mentions this man, Diotrephes, and he's basically kicked John out of the assembly and won't allow him to enter. And that's so interesting, because by the time John wrote that epistle, that's so late, right? That's likely the second oldest book of the Bible around there. It's really close. It's near the end chronologically. So by the time he wrote that epistle, the other apostles are likely all dead or sleeping. So we see Paul and Peter and James, they're struggling against the Judaizers. And by the time they're gone and John's the only one left, the Judaizers have such a stranglehold that they can even get away with forbidding a man like John from the assembly. And I think that's sort of a foreshadow, because it's located so near to the end chronologically. It's like a foreshadow showing the state of Christianity as John was in his twilight years. John is the last one left. He's about to go to sleep, and it's showing the state of Christianity, and it's so bad that even John's getting kicked out of places. And I was thinking of that, and I'm just like, wow, that's really profound. If you dwell on that, it's like a foreshadow.
Yeah, I agree. That's a good observation.
Well, I'll read the next bit then. That was interesting, though, Noble.
Yeah, I pray.
Then Joshua, having come into the regions of Caesarea Philippus, questioned his students, saying, who do men say that the Son of Man is? And they said, well, some John the Baptist, but others Elijah, and others Jeremiah, or one of the prophets. Jeremiah, or one of the prophets. He says to him, but who do you say that I am? And replying, Simon Peter said, you are the anointed Son of Yahweh who is living. And replying, Yahshua said to him, blessed you are, Simon, son of Jonas, because flesh and blood have not revealed it to you, but my Father who is in the heavens. And I say to you that you are a stone, yet upon this bedrock shall I build my assembly, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. I should say Hades there. And the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it. I shall give to you the little keys of the kingdom of the heavens, and he whom you should bind upon the earth shall be bound in the heavens, and he whom you should release upon the earth shall be released in the heavens. He ordered the students in order that they would tell no one that he is the anointed one.
I don't think it's an accident that this is placed here, because in Isaiah 56, we have a prophecy of estranged Israel, the eunuch, the dry tree, and the church. They twist it, trying to say it's a salvation for foreigners. Yahweh being God, he knew they were going to do it, so he puts a little address at the end, because he also knew what the chapter divisions would be in the future concerning dumb dogs, greedy, can't have enough. Luke, which is the gospel which has the most concerning Mary, that's the only gospel which has the woman crying out, blessed are the breasts upon which you sucked. And Christ replies, blessed rather is he who hears the law and follows it. And that's only in Luke, which is could be a subtle nod to the Catholic Church, right? Because that's the gospel they use for Mary worship. And then here, right after a warning concerning the leaven of the Pharisees, we have here the passage which the Catholic Church uses to justify their own leaven and to justify their own supposed authority over men right after it. I think that's pretty interesting.
It is, and yeah, you know, they're claiming that of Rome. Well, first, that's a lie. I mean, Rome had many churches where people elected themselves leaders of the churches, which are basically bishops. Before Peter even got to Rome, when Paul went to Rome, there were already Christians in Rome for nearly 30 years. We don't know who brought Christianity to Rome, but it was long before Paul had gotten to Rome. And the epistle to the Romans, which was written before Paul's arrest, in Rome before his arrest, and at least not in the context of his Christian ministry. He may have been there as a child. We'll never be able to answer that. We'll never know. But he was never in Rome as a Christian before his arrest, when he was sent to Roman bonds, probably around 62 AD. The epistle to the Romans was written before his arrest, around 59 AD, maybe 58. And there were already many established Christian congregations or churches. The term he used was ecclesia, which is assembly, in Rome. There were many of them. He had mentioned at least half a dozen of them, I think, mentioning people and the churches at the church that is at their house and language like that. So Christians established in Rome before ever arrived there. And that's evident because when Peter writes to the churches that Paul founded after Paul's death in 1st and 2nd Peter, Peter's in Babylon. He's not in Rome. I can question whether or not Peter actually ever went to Rome. And that's because I don't remember it from Christian writings until Eusebius of Caesarea, which is 338 AD. It might be in some earlier ones, but I don't remember it. I'd have to go research that. It's probably something I researched already, but my memory is faulty. So there were established in Rome long before Peter could have ever gotten to Rome. Peter was the apostle to the circumcised, and Paul was the apostle to the uncircumcised. There was a Judean minority in Rome, but there were many more uncircumcised Judeans. People of Judah and northern Syria in the cap from the remnants of the captivity than there were in Rome.
And the KJV has a translation here that the church has taken advantage of. They think that Christ told Peter that he is Peter, that thou art Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church, as if on Peter Christ will build his church. And they say, oh, well, now we're the heirs of Peter, so we have all the authority in the world to decide who goes to heaven and who doesn't, because the keys of the kingdom, and that whoever thou shalt bound on earth shall be bound in heaven. They think they have that authority. But then you check the CNT, the Christogenian New Testament, and it says, and I say to you that you are a stone, not that you are Peter, because obviously he is Peter. Yet upon this bedrock shall I build my assembly. And so that's actually contrary to what they claim. And it's in opposition to the passage that follows previously, because Christ is establishing a new church, not, you know, in contrast to the church of the Pharisees and the Sadducees and their authority. He's building a church by his authority on his bedrock.
Yes, he must be the bedrock. He must have been beating his chest or pointing to himself when he said those words. He's the bedrock, and Paul of Tarsus explains that in 1 Corinthians chapter 3, that he's the foundation upon which the church is built.
Which is what Christ teaches in the Sermon on the Mount when he says anyone who follows his words builds his house upon the bedrock. So, and right. His church is built upon his words.
The Roman Catholic apologists, they want to diminish or ignore the distinction between Petros and Petra, but the distinction is a great one. It's a significant distinction. Petros is a stone, and a Petra is an immovable rock or bedrock, as I have it translated, which is more than fair. And even Peter, his first epistle, describes himself as a lively stone, along with his followers. Ye also, as lively stones, are built up a spiritual house.
So Peter clearly understood the lesson, and we're all stones because we are the stones who make up the walls of the kingdom. We're that bride descending from heaven.
Yes. And it must have been purposeful that in his epistle, Peter didn't use the words Petra or Petros. He used a totally different Greek for stone, which is lithos.
Which is the same word John uses in the Revelation.
So that diminishes the importance of the Petros, right? Which is really only a stone.
Right.
And Petra is bedrock. And Paul thinks substantiates that in 1 Corinthians. And Peter, Petros means stone, but it's a sort of stone that you could pick up and cast. Christ was making a huge distinction there. You're a stone, but I'm going to build this church upon me, upon this bedrock. That's a significant distinction that the church purposely wants to obscure.
Which is really disgusting, because they're trying to take the glory away.
They knew the difference between Petros and Petra in the Middle Ages. They knew it.
It just sounds retarded too, like, you are Peter. And it's like, you are what? Like, why would he say, you are Peter? It just sounds so weird. Like if I met you, Bill, and I said, "You are Bill." It's like, yeah, I am. What's, you know, just, it's the way they've translated it just is weird.
They're so arrogant.
Well, tested in Galatians that the other apostles weren't any better than he was. I mean, the other apostles weren't venerating Peter.
No.
Even when in the book of Acts, Peter was just another apostle along with John and James. And it seems in the book of Acts that the veneration always went to James as being the eldest of the apostles.
Would James have really been the eldest, though? Because he would have been younger than Christ.
Yeah, but the sons of Zebedee were young.
Oh, you mean James, son of Zebedee? I thought you meant James, son of Alphaeus.
No, James, the brother of Christ, I think was older than the other apostles.
Yeah.
Because they seem to have deferred to him.
I always imagine the apostles as quite old. But James, since he's the son of Mary, he had to be younger than Christ, so he had to be likely in his 20s at the most. Christ was 30 when he began his ministry.
Right, but I think the sons of Zebedee were even younger.
Right, well, of course, right. Yeah, there's evidence for that. And John was
the
younger of the two.
John was the son of Zebedee, and James was his brother. He probably wasn't much older than John.
Well, I have a theory on that.
He was called, specifically called James the Less in the book of Acts. Which means that he was the younger
of the two James, yeah.
And evidently the other apostles were not older.
Right. I guess the whole old apostle thing is just a trope, really.
Well, it seems to me in the book of Acts in chapter 21, right? And the day following, Paul unto all the elders were present, meaning all of the other apostles.
Yeah, then we also can't forget Paul actually corrected Peter in Galatians 2:11-14.
How dare he correct the Holy Father? Wow, Catholics are triggered.
Chapter 12. Continued knocking, and when they had opened the door and saw him, they were astonished. But he, now these are the words of Peter, attributed to Peter, beckoning unto them with the hand to hold their peace, declared unto them how the Lord had brought him out of the prison, and he said, go show these things unto James and to the brethren. So Peter is singling James out as the elder.
Right. So if James is older than Peter, then Peter must have been in his early 20s.
Well, I mean, he was kicking it with the sons of Zebedee, so he was fine about their age.
That's true, right? I never considered this. I never considered it, right? Because it's that damn Catholic trope in your head of the apostles being old men with gray beards, and then John is the youth, and James, son of Zebedee, too, right? But the rest are like old men with beards. It's just a stupid trope that, like, you got to shake out of your head.
Right. John was the youth that much younger. He couldn't have been that much younger. All these men were in their 20s, say, when Christ began his ministry.
Now,
none of them were old men. None of them were learned. None of them were old men. Right. They may have become learned and had reason to after the crucifixion and the resurrection.
In the early, like right after Christ ascends, they begin taking teaching roles after the first Christian Pentecost. Wouldn't that suggest that they're at least 30? right? Considering the law in Numbers?
Yes and no, but are they under that law in Numbers in the New Testament? Come on.
Oh, no. And they're eating pork sandwiches, too?
Of course. Okra, no. Melissa and I sat in the pizza parlor, and I had to go to town on an errand. And I had no choice, so I quit work a little early. And I actually fell 4 documents short of putting a new Sex and Messenger site online. So we go to town, and on the way back, I told her we'd stop for a pizza. And this guy sat down next to us, and he was a real nice guy, and he was from Mississippi. And he orders a pie that he's going to take home for his wife. He ordered a pizza with pepperoni, ham, and bacon on it.
Yeah.
Wow.
Wow, it's like the whole deal. Bacon supreme. Wow.
How do you even talk to a guy like that?
I've always had a theory about why Christ selects out Peter, John, and James, because he does it when he raises the daughter of Jairus. He does it during the transfiguration, and he likely does it.
Right.
Yeah, and he likely does it in other instances as well that I can't remember. And it makes sense to see Peter and John there, right? Because Paul later calls those men pillars. So it makes sense to see Christ selecting them from the wider group. But yeah. James, the son of Zebedee, Paul does not call him a pillar. He dies early on. He dies quite early on. He's the first of the 11 to die.
He died in chapter 12, right?
Wow. Yeah, he died early. So you wonder, right? Why is he there? And sometimes and it's a conjecture. Peter, right? When he selects those three, it's not like Peter and Andrew and John and James. So Peter doesn't need to be in the company of his brother, right? Andrew isn't there. But John is in the company of James, which seems to suggest to me that they're both young, but James is the older, and he's sort of like the guardian of John. Like he's the one sort of watching over John, and John's quite younger than James. And that's always the impression I got from that, just a conjecture.
I mean, it might be. I mean, John is the youngest. Everybody else, I was really speaking about James and Peter, almost as old as James, but from those two passages in Acts, one of them in mouth of Peter, I just get the impression that James was the elder apostle, was the leader group after the departure of Christ, right after the ascension, and he was always named first in the book of Acts. In those few places where the apostles are referred to as a group, James is named first, so he's given a clear precedence.
Yeah. Yeah, I just wanted to mention that note on James, son of Zebedee, but I agree with you on James, son of Alphaeus. And if so, the Catholic interpretation...
James and John, who seem to be pillars, and Paul in Galatians is putting them in order of precedence by age, I think.
Right, that would make sense. Mary must have had James quickly after, right?
I mean, it could have been a couple of years.
Right.
It must have been. We're not going to know. We're never going to know precisely.
No. Well, we might know in the kingdom. But yeah, not in this life.
And we're never going to know. I don't think, like, Matthew seems to have been a full-grown man when he was a publican. When he was chosen by Christ, Matthew chapter 9, but was he 30? He didn't have to be a tax collector. The Romans didn't have any such age law, right? They had a totally different system than we have. So I'm sure somebody as young as 20 could work in a tax office.
Maybe he was an intern.
Well, I mean, Rome didn't have the same sort of civil service that we have today.
I was making a joke.
Tax collectors were actually private contractors in a sense that they were individuals that had agreements and sentence from the empire to collect taxes, or from the regional governor or whatever, to collect taxes in a certain region. And they could hire who they wanted.
And many of them collected extra taxes for the side, I'm sure.
Zebedee, taking anything unfairly, I'll return it fourfold, or whatever he said on the streets of Jericho. Something like that.
You're cutting out a bit, Bill. At least for me, I don't know.
I'm sorry, the tax collector on the streets of Zechariah, I think, on the streets of Jericho?
Right. Oh, Zacchaeus. You mean Zacchaeus.
Zacchaeus, yeah, Zacchaeus. I pronounce that. Well, he, I'm not going to say Zacchaeus wrong. He said, whatever I took unfairly or unjustly, I'll return fourfold, or something like that, he had said. Which is an admission right. That sometimes tax collectors collect too many taxes, right?
Right, and he was a just man.
Okay, Caesarea Philippi. Let me mention that briefly. Caesarea Philippi, the ancient site, to be near the, not far from Mount Hermon, and it's over 25 miles north of the northern coast of the Sea of Galilee. And Capernaum. Capernaum's on the northern coast of Galilee, the northwestern coast. Well, this is probably the Christ was also in Tyre, which is just as far north. So this is one of the furthest northern points that Christ is recorded as having traveled to. I don't believe he went to England.
What?
But it's somewhat southwest of Mount Hermon.
There's tin mines. There's tin mines, Bill. It was lucrative in Cornwall.
Right.
Is this the same Caesarea in which Paul was later imprisoned when he penned the epistle to the Hebrews or dictated it?
No, that's a different Caesarea that's actually on the Mediterranean coast.
Okay. Right, yeah.
That's why this Caesarea is distinguished as Caesarea Philippi. Caesarea Philippi was probably built by Philip Caesar. So it was called Caesarea of Philip. Where Caesarea on the coast was actually built by Herod in honor of Caesar, I believe, if I'm not mistaken.
Ass kissers.
And that was called Caesarea Maritima. Maritima because it was on the coast. So in Roman times, it was called Caesarea Maritima. So you had Caesarea Philippi, Caesarea Maritima, and there were other Caesareas in Anatolia and various other places.
Well, this part here where Christ says, "But who do you say that I am?" And they say, "You are the anointed son of Yahweh who's living." And then Christ says to him, "Blessed you are, because flesh and blood have not revealed it to you, but my Father who is in the heavens, right? So this would be racial. Still, even though he says flesh and blood have not revealed it to you, you have to have that spirit from God to perceive that Yahshua is the Christ. And this makes me think of that verse where they say, you know, test every spirit, because not every spirit is from God. He who professes that Yahshua is the Christ has come in the flesh, or, you know, that verse, he is from of Yahweh. He who denies that Yahshua has come in the flesh is the Antichrist, you know? So,
yeah.
The fact is that these apostles could perceive that Yahshua was the anointed son because of their spirit from God.
Yeah, like using Paul's language from Romans here, Peter's spirit is basically bearing witness with the spirit of Christ. He's recognizing Christ through the spirit. And yeah, it's 100% racial. That's great, Joe.
The light comes into the world, but the darkness comprehendeth not. Yeah. So they're not going to realize that Yahshua is the Christ. They can't.
I love how Christ here says, but who do you say that I am? Because that's a major theme in John's gospel, where Christ says that if I testify concerning myself, my testimony is not true. So he always has other men testify concerning him.
And it's revealed by Yahweh.
Yeah, through the Spirit. And it's a gift. You know, that's why Christ here says to Peter that he's blessed, because it's a gift. Like, when we think we realize things, but even when we realize something, we're not realizing it. It's a gift. God is doing that through us. We never really do anything on our own accord.
I think Solomon wrote in Wisdom of Solomon that wisdom that comes from God can only come to a man who's born purely.
Yeah, yeah. He says that wisdom can't dwell in a defiled body.
That's it. Yeah. Man, I was tripping a bit on that one. I was like, oh, I forgot the last bit of it.
Yeah, and that's so racial, like, man.
Yeah, it is. It obviously is.
Of course.
And so God only reveals his wisdom and the truth of who he is to the sons of Israel.
And it can only dwell in an undefiled body, because you can only have that wisdom, again, through the Spirit. The law is spiritual. All these things are spiritual. You're not going to comprehend it if you don't have the Spirit. The Spirit is the key. The Spirit is the cipher, if you want to put it that way. It's the cipher.
Yep. And broken cisterns hold no water.
No, so they would.
Okay.
They wouldn't be able to answer this question as Peter did. They would just turn to Peter and say that Peter's a holy father and he's the Pope. That's what they'd do.
Yeah, right. And Christ is supposed to be a little baby, so he'll be a little baby again after he gets resurrected. Okay, while y'all were talking, I looked up both of these Caesareas, and I was right about them both. That's amazing. Well, anyway, Caesarea Maritima was built by the first Herod, and it was actually a city called Stratos Tower. I knew that, but I didn't mention it. It was a Hellenistic era city. I don't know if it was built by Greeks or by Maccabees or by who, Stratos Tower, or what that used to be on the site of. I think I suspected ancient Dor at one time, but I don't think so. But it was near Dor. This tower named it after Caesar, Caesarea Maritima. It adopted that name, given that name Caesarea Maritima, not because it was named that, but only because it had to be distinguished from Caesarea Philippi, because Philip the Tetrarch, Herod's son, named Panius, an ancient city, and when he rebuilt it, he named it Caesarea Philippi. He probably didn't rename it Caesarea Philippi or Philip in honor of Caesar. I don't know if he named it that or he just named it Caesarea and it became the Caesarea Philippi after him, right? I'm not sure. But it mentions both of them in the articles as the builders of these cities, the articles I put in there. I just wanted to see, I want y'all to know the difference between them because it's confusing. All the Caesareas are confusing, just like there's so many men in the Bible named Herod. Yeah. In the history, he's named Herod, that it's confusing.
What makes it?
Agrippa, Herod Antipas. Herod Antipas in the scripture is only called Herod, and it's really Herod Antipas. I'm sorry, Joe.
I was just going to say it's even more confusing because they're all mixed up.
Probably where Herodotus got his name, too.
The Herod of Acts chapter 12 is only called Herod, and it's really his name is really Agrippa, Herod Agrippa 1. But then Agrippa is the Herod Agrippa 2 in Acts chapter 26. That's Herod Agrippa 2, and he's called Agrippa. Yeah, I mean, Herod is from a Greek word, right? And Herodotus certainly did get his name from that same word. But I think only in part, because I think Herodotus is a compound name. And the dotus part means gifts, I think. It's gift of a god. Or gift from Herodotus might be gift from a hero. I mean, I'm not entirely sure of that, but I think.
Well, he certainly wasn't a hero.
Well, it's the gift of a hero, I think. Okay.
Would verse 19, right, concerning the keys, I'm thinking of the verse in Galatians. I want to use it as an example. In Galatians 3, I just got to look at it because I forget how it's worded. Yeah, Galatians 3:29. But if you are Christ's, and then of the offspring of Abraham, you are heirs according to promise. And like we know how the church misinterprets that. They view it as like a sequence of events, but really it's just like, if you're this, then that also means you're that. Well, here in Matthew, I think it might be a little similar of an idea, because perhaps, like this is an interpretation, the apostles, they all agreed with Christ. And they were given the Holy Spirit at the first Christian Pentecost, and even before that, because Luke says that he breathed the Spirit into them after his resurrection. So I think it really just represents the fact that they agree with God. So when they do something like that, their will is in accordance with the will of God because they're obedient men. I think it's just really acknowledgement that they're walking with God.
Would what verse be is this? Because where's the if?
Yeah, that's Galatians 3:29. I was just using that as an example in my introduction there, just to give this idea, because I think it's a similar thing happening. I don't know how to describe it. There's likely a word in grammar or something.
Yeah, in Galatians, there's that if there, which means it's a conditional sentence. If you're this, then... You know, but what are you saying in Matthew 16? What are you referring to in this chapter?
I'm referring to the little keys. So 19, okay. I shall give to you the little keys of the kingdom of the heavens, and he whom you should bind upon the earth shall be bound in the heavens, and he whom you should release upon the earth shall be released in the heavens. So the ordinary interpretation of that, as the Catholics use it, and I don't know how Protestants do it, but I'm sure it's quite similar, is that he's giving the apostles a special authority, which other men wouldn't have. And then that authority, the church, the Catholic Church, of course, believes they inherit through apostolic tradition. And I'm just giving forth another interpretation, which is just an acknowledgement that their will matches the will of God. That is just acknowledging the fact that these men will walk with God, and therefore their will is aligned.
There's no conditional sentence there. But what I would say is I would cross-reference that to John 1, where it says, but as many as received him, to them gave he power to become the sons of God. Oh, I'm reading from the KJV. Sorry, one sec.
Yeah,
but as many who received him, he gave to them the authority which the children of Yahweh are to attain to those believing in his name, not those from mixed origin, nor from of the desire of the flesh. So the true children of Yahweh are going to have authority and power.
You know, that's likely a better interpretation. Now that I think about it, that I think that's a better interpretation, because here, Christ isn't speaking to Peter or maybe even just the apostles, but he might be speaking concerning a condition which the race will obtain once that kingdom is established upon the bedrock, once that is finalized in its most ultimate form. Yeah, that's a pretty good interpretation, Joe.
Two chapters later, even though he seems to be talking to Peter here, right, he is in context. Two chapters later, in chapter 18, he's speaking to his disciples generally, to the group, and saying, "Verily I say to you that whatsoever you shall bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, whatsoever you shall loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven." So the whole group.
Right. And even has maybe
like authority with Peter. He's not the Lord of the other apostles, in other words.
No, of course.
And there's nowhere that he's exalted above the other apostles in later scriptures. As we saw, Paul even put James in precedence.
Right, of course. But it might even be more wider reaching than that, right? Like Joe's saying, it might be applicable to the entire race.
I think it's applicable to every single Christian.
Right.
And that's because you can't have the God without being obedient to him.
And like it says in chapter 1 of John, you know, it's not going to be for mixed race mongrels or anything like that. Those of mixed origin.
Would this be cross-referenced to Paul when he writes to Timothy concerning sins going opened or closed? As in closed being binded and open being released here?
Yeah, you know, I just started looking at a podcast I did 4.5 years ago that I thought about, and it was based on a Comparate sermon, and it was titled "What is Religion?" And I could critique a Comparate sermon, but in my introduction to it, I said, so binding and loosing are related to Christian fellowship and community or communion. That in turn is based on an abstention from sin and a keeping of the commandments of God. Paul's example of such loosing is found in 1 Corinthians chapter 5, where he encouraged the assembly at Corinth to ostracize a fornicator from their community. I said that in conjunction with the appearance of loosing in Matthew chapter 18. And so that's what Christ said, "My brother shall trespass against thee, go and tell him his fault between thee and him alone. If he shall hear thee, thou hast gained thy brother. But if he will not hear thee, then take with thee one or two more, that in the mouth of two or three witnesses every word may be established. And if he shall neglect to hear them, tell it to the church or the assembly. But if he neglects to hear the assembly, let him be unto thee as a heathen man and a publican," somebody that you would reject as a Christian. Then, after admonishing his disciples about sin and guilt and the need to reject men who do not accept correction along those lines, Yahshua Christ had also said, "Verily I say to you that whosoever shall be bound on earth shall be bound in heaven." And that's why I made that conclusion that binding and loosing have to do with Christian fellowship and community.
So basically,
if men don't have your fellowship on the earth for their sins, because you had to put them away, that basically they're going to be perhaps resurrected to eternal contempt.
Right, like that segregation in the kingdom, which is possible, which could be conjectured upon when you see those outside the walls in Revelation, that shame. So yeah, that would make sense. You bind them upon the earth, you have fellowship with them on the earth, and therefore you will have reward together in the kingdom, and you will fellowship in the kingdom and rejoice in your labor. And Paul sort of brings that up in his epistle to the Philippians. He wants them to be obedient so that they can rejoice together with him. And that not in vain has he run, nor in vain has he labored. So, yeah, that makes sense. And then releasing them upon the earth, sort of how, like you said, Bill, they release that fornicator to the adversary for destruction of the flesh, even though in the end, Corinth actually decided to bind him in the end, when you look at 2 Corinthians.
Right.
Yeah, okay, well, that makes a lot of sense. Thanks, Bill.
The this people is something... had more mercy than Paul would have had with them.
Yeah, they did, and Paul chose to respect that. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. I thank you for that. This is something I should have studied more. We always got to study more. Thank you. That makes a lot of sense.
Well, I pray it's right, but that's context. That's a precise context where right. these words repeated in Matthew chapter 18.
Right. No, and I see what you're saying, and I can see how it has harmony, right? I see the harmony. That makes sense.
Y'all want me to keep reading?
I mean, we could spend another 15, 20 minutes and try to finish this chapter.
Yeah.
If you want.
The next bit, yeah, it might be a bit hefty, but I'll go for it. From that time, Yahshua Christ began to explain to his students that it is necessary for him to depart for Jerusalem and to suffer many things from the elders and high priests and scribes, and to be slain and to be raised on the third day. And taking him aside, Petros began to admonish him, saying, "Mercy to you, Prince, this shall not be for you." And turning, he said to Petros, "Get behind me, adversary. Are you a trap for me? Because you mind not the affairs of Yahweh, but the affairs of men." Then Yahshua said to his students, "If one desires to come behind me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For he who would wish to save his life shall lose it, and he who would lose his life because of me shall find it. For what shall it benefit a man if perhaps he should gain the whole society, but his life is lost? Or what shall a man give in exchange for his life? The Son of Man is going to come with the splendor of his Father with his messengers, and then he shall render to each according to his practice. Truly, I say to you that there are some of those standing here who shall by no means taste death until when they should see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom."
I think one of the best cross references you can have here for Peter being an adversary would be James, when James says that anybody who has friendship with the society establishes himself as an enemy of God. Right here, Peter is minding the affairs of men, so his mind is with the society. So for this moment, he's establishing himself as an enemy of God, how James put it.
He's simply demanding that something happen contrary to the will of God, which is Christ is God come in the flesh. Peter had just professed that essentially. He had just professed that you are the anointed son of Yahweh who is living. or Yahweh who lives. So Peter just essentially professed that Christ is God come in the flesh, that that's the Messiah, the Redeemer of Israel. Men understood. Now all of a sudden he's speaking, when Christ explains the will of God, what Christ says must be the will of God because he's God and Peter professed that. And Peter goes right off and is the words of Christ, which are the expression of the will of God. So he's functioning as a Satan, as an adversary. If we fill our hearts with Christ, then we can't object to any of his words without being an adversary.
Of course.
He expects his students to take up their own cross and follow him. Yet right. Peter was sort of opposing the cross, like, oh, yeah, so Peter was opposing the cross. Then Christ sets the standard. This is the standard. If one desires to come behind me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. And Peter needs to understand that.
Well, the affairs of Yahweh are spelled out in the words of the prophets, and the Messiah, which Peter just professed Christ to be, was to be cut off in chapter 9. It's very clear. And it's that's corroborated by 6, I think it is, right? Let me look. I'm sorry, I don't know the Bible. Just look up the word stripes. It's Isaiah chapter 53. He was wounded for our transgressions, he was bruised for our iniquities. So that's the word of God, and how could you oppose it without being a devil or acting like an adversary? So Peter was acting like an adversary, and Christ told it. Christ told him that. I mean, adversary, are you a trap for me? And Peter's words deserved that response. They were worthy of that response. Because he said it imperatively, this shall not be for you. So that's a direct and explicit contradiction. So he was, Christ told him what had to happen. That there was no maybe about it.
It also shows you that the will of God triumphs over a man's emotions. Because yes. Right here, Peter's being an emotional baby. And he doesn't want to see Christ die because he loves him. And we can all understand that, right? We can understand that. But he's not putting the will of God first, because if you put the will of God first, you will see how this is necessary, how this is good, how it's working for the good of all of us. And you will love the will of God because you know his will is good, even though it might trouble you for a while that Christ would have to die. So right here, he's putting his emotions before his obedience to the will of God.
Now, how many people do we see do that? Come and go from our chats and our forums?
Too many. Way too many.
Sort of, you can choose the society, which is a fallen society, or you can choose the life, with the true life, which is Yahweh. It's like people betray the true life to gain the whole society. But what are they really gaining? You know, this corrupt, mongrel society. Fuck that. You know, Noah did it. Like, who wants to gain the society that Noah was living in? That all, you know, all flesh had become corrupt. You know, we don't need that world. You're not gaining anything.
I like what you're saying, Joe, about the true life, because that's what Christ is talking about here. He's talking about that better resurrection. And Paul uses that language, better resurrection, in Hebrews. And then to Timothy, he uses the language which you used, the true life. And the true life is when you're resurrected to that better resurrection, which is why Christ says in John that some men will be resurrected to a resurrection of life and others will be resurrected to a resurrection of condemnation or judgment. And that's shame. So that's your true life. Like, I just want to say, like, when you're resurrected and you're resurrected to be in that better resurrection, and you have works that were behind you, and you can rejoice in that, and you've been rewarded, and you're shining like the luminaries forever, and you're with your God, and you're close to Him, you can serve Him. Is there any life more true than that? That's the true life. That's you living your life to the fullest. And if you're resurrected to shame, well, that's not like, really the true life. I'm sorry.
I'd cut you off. That's the life that Paul spoke of quite often.
Right. Yeah. So it's the true life. And if you're being resurrected to shame, you're losing your life. You're not going to have the true life in the kingdom. You're not going to have the full capacity for a life that you could have had. You're going to have a half life.
And that's why Christ said it's better to enter into heaven with one hand. It's better to enter into life having one hand than to suffer in the fires of Gehenna.
Right, Bill.
Yeah. And these things, they can strike fear in a man's heart, because I know they strike fear into mine. These things remind me every day that I have to take my life seriously and I have to run this race, because this is the only shot we have.
But death's really,
you know what? I'm not saying I have any great accomplishments or anything. I'm kind of comfortable with having resigned myself to the fact that Yahweh God knows where I'm going to end up, and I have to accept His will, so it don't matter. And while I'm here, I'm just going to do the best I can. But no. Here I have comfort in that.
Well, I have comfort in it too. I have comfort in it too. It's just maybe I shouldn't have said that it strikes fear in my heart. Maybe I should have said it lights a fire under my ass. You know, like it encourages me to get going. And then that comfort comes from doing that.
You have something to say, Ram?
I'm just saying death should really be a beautiful thing. And this is, and we've made it a horrible thing. And I know you'll miss your loved ones when they go on, but it should be beautiful. And the Bible tells us to weep when they enter and rejoice when they leave. And we do the opposite. We shouldn't fear death. I fear suffering. I don't fear death.
And the true
death is a relief. Go ahead, Joe.
The true life is also in Matthew 16:28, where it says, "Truly I say to you that there are some of those standing here who shall by no means taste death until they should see the Son of Man come in His kingdom." And a lot of scoffers will say, "Oh, well, that didn't happen. They all died. Ha ha ha." But it's speaking of the true life. If you're with Christ, you have that true life, and you're not going to taste death. And Christ said, and it astonished the crowds when He said, "Yahweh is the God of the living. Yahweh is the God of Jacob, Isaac, and Abraham." And, you know, so He's saying that they're still living. They're still, you know, He's the God of the living. He's the God of Jacob, Isaac, and Abraham. He's not the God of the dead.
And that's why death should not bother us.
Exactly. And Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are righteous men. So when they died, they entered into life. But if you live a...
Very next, I'm sorry. In chapter 17, the very next episode in the Gospel of Matthew proves that.
Right, when you see Moses and Elijah. Right.
Right.
No, I just wanted to say... Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, they were righteous, God-fearing men, and they entered into that life when they died. And if you are a reproachable man and you die, you're not entering into the true life. And it reminds me of Paul when he writes to Timothy concerning whorish woman. And he says that she living lewdly is living dead.
I just want to know why, if they had no graven images, they knew it was Moses and Elijah. I'm kidding, but no, I'm not.
In Matthew 22, it says, I am the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac and the God of Jacob. He is the God of the, he is not the God of the dead, but of the living. So that's the meaning in verse 28 here too, is that if you're with the God of the living, you're not going to taste death.
Which is why exactly. Christ, when he came into the house of Jairus to raise his daughter, he pretty much offended everybody when he said, she's not dead, she's sleeping. And he offends them. And then Stephen, when Stephen's martyred, Luke writes in Acts that, you know, upon that final stone being cast, he fell asleep. And you see this language everywhere. In the Old Testament, the kings, right, they sleep with their fathers. Yeah. Yahweh tells Moses in Deuteronomy, it's time for you to sleep.
In right? Acts,
it's always the sleeping.
The saints are all with Christ. Paul wanted to go, said that it was preferable for him to be with Christ, and he meant in death. So yeah, they're all with Christ in death, and they will see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. They will say, Abraham rejoiced to see his day. Abraham saw Christ in his day. Abraham rejoiced. How did he rejoice after death? Because just as Abraham saw his day, these people standing there back then would see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. They would see that day, even if they passed, even if they died, they would not taste death. They would see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom, just as Abraham rejoiced.
And right. Your consciousness clearly continues when you die. And we can't ever speculate what that means or how that works, but it's quite clear, as Bill says, when we look in the next chapter, we see that Moses and Elijah are not dead. They're not dead. And it's such a beautiful promise, because Moses died, Elijah was translated, and they both have the same destination.
And no, I relate that to like a dream, a good dream, okay?
Yeah.
It's in John 8. Your father Abraham rejoiced that he would see my day, and he has seen it and is delighted.
Yahshua could have conversed with Abraham on that mountain just as easily as anyone else.
And look at this. Then the Judeans say to him, the Judeans, you know, we all know who this is. You do not yet have 50 years, and you have seen Abraham? Yahshua said to them, truly, truly, I say to you, before Abraham came to be, I am. Then they took up stones in order that they would cast them at him, but he hid and departed from the temple. See, so they didn't get it. They didn't get it then.
And they don't get it now.
They'll never understand, because they don't have that spirit. They'll never see that he is the Christ. They will never have life.
Death should not be what we're making in this society.
No. My wife and I, we went to a church a couple months ago, and they were all crying because some church member died recently. And they were all like freaking out over it. It's like, where's the faith? Where's the faith?
They don't understand the scripture, Noel. Now, don't get me wrong. I will miss the people. I'm not saying that.
No, of course.
We should not enter the state of mind that we enter at the death of one of our loved ones, okay? We need to if you understand the scripture, you won't enter that state. That's when life begins, not ends.
Well, even...
Yeah. But even with that, I have problems. I hate dealing with death, man. I really do. I had a really hard time burying Clifton. It was... I don't know. You just miss your other ones.
Yeah, but Bill, with that, and that's what I was saying, you will miss them, and there's no problem with that, but you understand where Clifton's at, too, on the same hand.
Of course. Even Christ cried when Lazarus was dying, but he was really crying over the lack of faith of the people, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think that too.
You know, Elijah and his armor bearer was going to war to take on a whole town, and his armor bearer was frightened, and he asked the Father to open the heavens and show him who was with him. And the heavens opened, it says, right above their head, and there was tens of thousands of chariots going with them. So I look at this thing as probably dimensional, and Clifton may be sitting right above our head at another level that we can't see into. Just my opinion.
Is that Second Maccabees you were quoting?
I think so.
Yeah, it reminds me of a scene in Second Maccabees.
Yeah, regarding what you're saying, though, Ram, I think an excellent example is when David's baby was sick and dying, and he fasted and prayed for many days. He wouldn't eat, and then when he finally heard the baby was dead, he got up and ate and washed himself.
Yep,
exactly.
And they were asking the same questions, why do you do this now? And he said, because now he is with God, so why should I mourn?
Exactly, David. Thank you. I just think the stronger we are as a body of people and understanding death, the better off we are.
I guess we could put this up here.
Okay.
We could discuss the same subject in the opening of chapter 17 because it's the same subject. It really is.